This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a call for a new kind of peace movement, one that cares about the whole of humanity. Mumia Abu-Jamal's lawyers believe they have a good case for ending his long incarceration. And the government of Colombia has detained two women activists in the struggle for Black territorial and community rights.
But first, President Trump's national security advisor, John Bolton, is said to have never seen a war he didn't like. But that applies to a lot of Republicans and Democrats. We spoke with Phyllis Bennis, director of the New International Project at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington. Bennis thinks Bolton is an especially dangerous man.
It's been fascinating to watch the consistency of Bolton's positions over the years. I'm always a bit hesitant even to describe him as a neocon, because there's no real evidence that he believes in any kind of commitment to what the neocons like to talk about, although they don't do it, of rebuilding countries that we destroy in the interests of, in the name of, and in the image of our own country. He is simply a militarist. He has never seen an international challenge, an international crisis, an international problem that did not require direct U.S. military intervention to solve it. Get in, overthrow the bad guys, and get out. And the consequences to those left behind, be damned.
Well, U.S. policy often seems to see the military or the threat of military force as not a last resort, but a first and constant resort.
That's absolutely right. But I think it is important to recognize that there are different forces, there are different political tendencies and factions, but there are also individuals who play, at times, very identifiable roles in pushing forward that long-standing U.S. policy position. So for Bolton, for example, in the period in the run-up to the war in Iraq in 2002, early 2003, he was, ironically enough, at the time the Assistant Secretary of State for Disarmament Affairs. Kind of interesting, given that he never wanted to disarm anything. But there he was. And when the question came up about going to war in Iraq, there was a divide within the Bush administration, Colin Powell leading one rather feckless faction, and a much more powerful faction that would probably say was led by the Cheney-Rumsfeld gang, that were much clearer about the need for immediate war in Iraq. What Bolton did, Bolton played a key role there, not just as a cheerleader, which he certainly was, but as an active tool in the interest of making sure that the war happened. And one of the things he did to accomplish that was to make sure that there was no possibility of a negotiated solution to the challenge of Iraq's alleged weapons of mass destruction, which many of us knew then and everybody knows now, did not exist. But there was a claim that there were chemical weapons, biological weapons, etc., and that was used as one of the most important justifications for the war. Bolton took one look at that and said, you know, we could do something about that. Because one of the things that was happening at the time was that the leader of the main international organization charged with dealing with chemical weapons, it's called the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the head of it was a Brazilian diplomat, a guy named José Bustani, and he was negotiating fast and furiously with Saddam Hussein's government, encouraging them to join the organization, to become a signatory to that treaty, which, if it happened, would have meant that incredibly intrusive inspections would have gone on the way they do for any country that joins that organization and signs that treaty. That would have taken away the justification for the war. Now, as we know, truth has never been a problem. When it turns out that the truth doesn't hold up the excuses, they go to war anyway. But that wasn't clear at that moment. There still was a sense it might have been prevented. And Bustani was working very hard to have that happen. When Bolton looked at that, he said, oh, no, this is not acceptable. We can't have a diplomatic solution here. We want a war. So Bolton went to Bustani. Bustani wrote about this about 3 or 4 years ago and told him, you're out. You've got 24 hours to resign. Bustani answered, I was just reappointed for a second four-year term by the 145 member states of this organization, the signatories to this treaty. I'm not going anywhere. And he later admitted that Bolton actually threatened his children. But he was tough, and he stood up and said, I'm not resigning. Bolton then went to enough member states and used the tried-and-true U.S. tactics of bribes and threats and punishments and got enough of them to vote to fire Bustani just a few weeks later. So Bustani was out, replaced by a very malleable type, let's say, who would do whatever the U.S. wanted. And there was no possibility. The Iraqis pulled back and never signed on to the chemical weapons treaty. And the war went ahead. So the actions that Bolton took individually were very tied into ensuring that these wars happened. This wasn't just somebody who kind of was a cheerleader for war. This was somebody working really, really hard to make sure that war happened and that diplomacy failed.
And some believe or fear that that particular UN agency can't be trusted to come up with a finding on chemicals that would anger the United States today. But shouldn't we look at people like John Bolton as a kind of weapon that the United States leadership can choose to bring out anytime it wants to? He's a weapon of known characteristics and caliber. And so it's not the Boltons that make war. They're just the weapons chosen to do so.
Well, I think that's true. I do think, though, after being in Washington for a very long time, that I would say I've adjusted my thinking a bit on how institutions work. I once believed that institutions functioned without regard to the people running them, and I actually don't think that's the case entirely anymore. I think that individuals do play a role in this town, generally a very nefarious role. But I think it's a mistake to assume that individuals are not important, that they can be replaced at any moment. They play different roles at different times, that's certainly true, and they are used and abused by others. But I would hold Bolton very much responsible for some of the ravages of these wars that have resulted from the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq.
Well, if that's the case, then the institution of the U.S. government is full of weapons like Bolton. Nikki Haley, UN ambassador, said that the United States would respond to the alleged Syrian chemical attack, whether the U.N. Security Council okayed it or not. And that is threatening an act of war in violation of international law.
And that's exactly the same language. Those of us, you and I, are both old enough to remember that exact language being reported by the U.S. ambassadors and various other officials at the United Nations in 2002 and early 2003, when the United States was again making clear that regardless, we would like to have the Security Council endorse our war, but if they don't, no problem, we're going to war anyway. So yes, that is a longstanding practice of the U.S., that kind of violation of international law, violation of UN Security Council resolutions, have never troubled the United States. It goes back to the origins of the United Nations. It's one of the parts of the history that I wrote about in my book on U.S. domination of the UN that goes back to the very founding of the organization when the precursor to the CIA didn't even exist yet, but the precursor intelligence agencies, as they like to call them, to the CIA was surveilling the delegations heading to San Francisco for the conference to create the United Nations. So going into those negotiations, the U.S. knew exactly what was important to every delegation and what they would be willing to give in on. So it put them in a very, very strong position, and they have used that kind of abuse of the system, particularly in its role as the so-called host country, for more than 60 years.
Yes, we keep on talking about threats of war, but of course the United States is constantly involved in real acts of war. And Wesley Clark famously revealed that the United States had a plan to attack and overthrow the governments of 7 countries. In the aftermath, the United States did attack in one way or another all of them and overthrew some of them. That institutionally sounds like an entity that is constantly violating the Nuremberg principles against aggressive war, which is the highest crime that any country can commit.
Certainly true. The U.S. history of wars has been a history, a legacy that goes back to the wars against the native population of this continent, that there has been no stopping U.S. militarism. I think that's absolutely true. I do think that, again, we have to be nuance, let's say, in our thinking about things like the famous list of 7 countries. There is no doubt. I have no doubt that there's a list of 10 countries in Asia and maybe 15 countries in Africa that somebody in the U.S. government also says they want to invade and overthrow. And in many cases, U.S. troops have been used illegally in many of those places. I don't think the fact that there's a plan or a desire, either one, because both exist in enormous numbers of papers of various sorts in every U.S. agency saying we intend to or we want to overthrow X governments, that doesn't necessarily mean it's an actual strategy that is collectively being imposed by the government as a whole. Sometimes they make it, sometimes they don't, sometimes they try for it, sometimes the people who were responsible for that particular strategy are out of power for a particular period of time and it gets put back on the shelf and maybe taken off the shelf again. But I think that what's consistent is the notion that the U.S. is prepared to use its unchallengeable military capacity in terms of the financing, the power of the U.S. military, including the threats to use nuclear weapons, the U.S. being, of course, the only country that's actually used them, and the country that more than any other threatens to use them, that it is willing to use that military force to gain its empowerment around the world in the form of military bases, in the empire of bases, there's more than 800 U.S. bases around the world, in the form of control of oil, natural gas, other strategic resources, in the form of control of water, which is increasingly in such short supply in so many parts of the world. In all of these ways, the U.S. willingness to use military force is absolutely consistent. And I would say it goes way beyond the desires of the drafters of the famous Wesley Clark 7 countries memo. I would imagine there's probably a number of other countries beyond those 7.
Well, doesn't all this mean, doesn't the U.S. history since World War II mean that the United States has effectively mooted the Nuremberg standards as bars to aggression by repeatedly violating them?
Yes, and I think it's important to recognize that even during the time of Nuremberg, the Justice Jackson, who was a U.S. judge, who was the one who wrote the famous analysis about the need for things like the Nuremberg principles to be applied to the victors as well as the losers in any world conflict, has never been taken seriously in the United States. The U.S. has always viewed, and I would say the U.S. is not the only country, the Nuremberg trials were victor's justice, as has other parts of international law. It doesn't mean that it's not something we need as civil society to use as tools to demand justice, to demand an end to the militarization of foreign policy, the militarization of diplomacy, the wars that are slaughtering people, whether in Afghanistan, in Syria, in Libya, in across the world. But I think it does speak to the consistency, again, of U.S. policy of what they like to call American exceptionalism. The United States is the only country that asserts in a legal framework the notion that it is exempt from every part of international law, from the Nuremberg principles to the United Nations Charter, that it threatens to go to war against other countries who might violate one small component of that international law. So this is a very consistent part of U.S. policy. It comes, and I think you're absolutely right, to frame it around the post-World War II period when the U.S. emerged as by far the most powerful of the victors of World War II, the only one that had not itself been devastated militarily, physically, and humanly by the war, the only one that did not have parts of the war fought on our territory. So it was not a surprise that the U.S. at that point emerged as the most powerful and the wealthiest country in the world. And it has managed to maintain that privilege for all these years.
Yes, the United States behaves as if it's exempt from international law, a kind of exceptionalism, and then it put forward its own version of law in the form of so-called humanitarian military intervention, which in practice, well, in practice, is it not a violation of the law against aggressive war?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the ironies, of course, is that the whole notion of humanitarian intervention is now really not even being talked about in all of the arenas where the U.S. and other major powers are fighting, for example, in Syria, where you have a host of U.S. and U.S. proxies and Russia and other forces that are fighting each other in at least 11 separate wars that have nothing to do with Syria, and where the Syrians are only doing the dying. So it's a horrific reality, but it is a reality that we've seen even, ironically, in the run-up to the war in Libya, the U.S.-NATO attack on Libya that has left Libya in such a devastated state now. At the time, there was a debate going on in the U.N. Security Council. It was supposed to be a very limited so-called no-fly zone, and it was the U.S. Secretary of Defense, who's supposed to be the big military guy, arguing against the then Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, who's supposed to be the big diplomat. Clinton, of course, was supporting the idea of a U.S.-NATO attack on Libya, but Robert Gates, the Secretary of Defense, was opposed to it, and he was the one who said in that debate at the United Nations, let's be clear, he actually said, let's call a spade a spade. A no-fly zone starts with going to war against Libya. And he went on to detail what that meant, that you can't just announce a no-fly zone, that the first thing you have to do is attack the country to take out the existing anti-aircraft system, whatever anti-aircraft defense system it had. Now, Libya barely had an anti-aircraft system, but he was very clear that it was still an act of war, that that's what a no-fly zone meant. So it was the head of the Pentagon, essentially, saying, here's the deal. A no-fly zone is not just some nice humanitarian thing. It's an act of war.
That was Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington.
President Trump came into office promising to be tough on China, and he's been pushed by the Democrats to increasingly confront Russia. However, with Asia now not only the population center of the planet, but also home to the most dynamic economies, the U.S. role in the world seems more and more to be holding back human progress. In Philadelphia, Du Boisian scholar and lifelong activist Dr. Anthony Monteiro says what's needed in the U.S. is a new kind of peace movement.
I would agree with you, and I would like to respond by underlining your emphasis upon the development of the world's productive forces. And the center of this at the present moment is Asia, including China, India, the Koreas, and the Eurasian landmass that we call Russia or the former Soviet Union. And the reason I wish to emphasize the development of the productive forces as productive forces and positive technological developments that would serve humanity, because this is the opposite of what is occurring in the West, especially the United States, where the productive forces, under conditions of decadent social relationships of production, are increasingly and rapidly being transformed into destructive forces. Hence, the disproportionate amount of the resources of a country like the United States, which go into the military and updating nuclear arsenals and preparation for war as a way of retarding the development of the productive forces in such a way that the productive forces become part of the reconfiguration of world social and economic relationships away from capitalism and towards socialism. And I think at the end of the day, this great global struggle centers upon that which you pointed to in the beginning.
And this is the real meaning of austerity forever and growing militarism.
Absolutely. And this makes the development of a peace movement of a new type in the United States so necessary. A peace movement of a new type. That is a peace movement which centers upon precisely what you emphasized in the beginning, the development of humanity and the productive forces of humanity to serve the uplift, the development of humanity as such. And most people who are peace activists are only looking at the most recent U.S. intervention. That is not the type of peace movement we need. We need a peace movement that is linked to human development, to an end to imperialism and austerity, and again, which emphasizes the development of the productive forces. And as the productive forces develop, the revolutionizing of the relationships between peoples, between civilizations, between nations, if you will. And that's what we call the revolutionizing of the relationships of production.
You seem to be talking about a kind of peace movement that doesn't just look at the last atrocity, the last bombing by the United States, but looks at the world from a larger kind of framework and therefore makes different kinds of demands.
That's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a peace movement that has a vision of humanity, not just a peace movement that is, in essence, a U.S.-centered or a nationalist, a white nationalist peace movement, a peace movement that in substance says that we want peace because these wars are not good for white folk. We should argue we want peace because these wars are not good for humanity. And we should put, if we are really about peace and this new type of peace movement that I'm suggesting, it is not that we focus upon white folk, but that we focus upon humanity and that we put humanity first, even before the so-called national interest of Americans.
Well, the economic interests of Americans certainly are not linked to austerity, which impoverishes more and more Americans.
Well, that's true. But neither would we be for a peace, which is a peace in the what we call the social imperialist sense, a peace which serves the American people, but is not a peace for the rest of the world. Let me give you an example. Donald Trump is now lauding and praising the summit between the leaders of North and South Korea as a step towards denuclearization and peace on the Korean Peninsula. But Donald Trump is a white nationalist, which is the same as saying an American nationalist. So his idea of peace is a peace that serves American interests, not the interests of the Korean people, the Asian people, or of humanity itself. I can give you another example. The current summit between the Prime Minister of India, Modi, and the President of China, Xi Jinping, and the way they talk about peace between their two nations is by looking back 2,000 years, where Modi says that for 1600 of the last 2000 years, China and India were the engines of human progress, and that to go forward in the 21st and 22nd centuries, China and India must restore relationships that existed in their past, in their ancient past. Now, I would just differ with one thing with Modi, that the world that China and India inhabited for 1600 years was also a world that included Africa and the great trade routes between Africa and Asia and the transfer of civilization between the two continents. But this is very positive. And if I might also add that Kim Jong-un, the head of state of North Korea, in his meeting with the South Korean president, said that the people of the North and South are of the same blood. And to kind of paraphrase Sly Stone, and blood is thicker than mud. Another way of saying that the Korean people have a history together and they can resolve their problems without the white West.
Well, certainly blood ties are no mystery to the West, the United States and Europe, that is, the white world, are still locked together in military embrace in opposition to most of the non-white world.
There's no question about it. But in a lot of ways, and we've talked about this quite a bit over the years, Glenn, we're at a turning point. India and China constitute at this point 40% of the world's population. It is predicted that by the middle of the 21st century, the two largest economies in the world will be India and China. Now, I know the size or magnitude of a national economy does not resolve the crises that are inherited from colonialism and semi-colonialism, but nonetheless, the West is receding. The East and South are on the incline. This is a decisive shift in world history. And so the crisis that led to the election of Trump is a political crisis throughout Europe. In China, there's not such a political crisis. On the Korean Peninsula, the Koreas and their leaders are resolving long-standing political crises. China and India are finding ways to resolve long-standing political crises. And we might add to the mix of the successes of the government in Syria over the Western-backed jihadists and counter-revolutionaries. So in a lot of ways, the world looks far more positive in the trajectory of its development than does the West. The West is in crisis. The rest of the world is finding ways to overcome the crises that they have inherited.
And you seem to be saying that a new type of peace movement would celebrate these advances, these economic advances in that part of the world, in the East, and celebrate further and deepening of ties among those countries as an advance for all of humanity.
That's right. And that's what I'm saying. And a peace movement that not only looks at the United States in a kind of social imperialist way, but has its eyes also on the rest of the world, on Africa and Asia. In fact, I would say, Glenn, a peace movement that looks at civilization rather than nations. And that's the way, you know, as I suggested earlier, Modi and Xi Jinping are talking about renewing ties between India and China based upon civilizations, ancient civilizations.
Well, in the United States, including among some folks who call themselves progressives and leftists, civilization arcs from Greece through Rome through Britain and now at its pinnacle in the United States.
Yeah, true. And that's the problem. We need a different vision. We need a different ideological perspective. We need a different worldview. And, of course, the advocates of peace, as they are, must educate themselves and be educated about the world. And really, you know what we're talking about, Glenn? We're talking about a break ideologically with liberalism and social democracy and its ultra-left type of handmaidens. We're looking towards a new world, a future that is not in the West, not in the white world, but in the darker nations of the world. And this is something very uncomfortable for a lot of white Americans in particular, and for a good number of black people who become the spokespeople for white interests.
The Chinese Project, it's a One Belt, or sometimes called Silk Road Project, now does include Africa. But Africa is a continent that is increasingly occupied militarily by the United States, supposedly as part of its war on terror.
And in a lot of ways, we're back to the 19th century, where now led by the United States, the West wants to once again partition Africa. But to do that, they have to break the back of the movements for self-determination, which means that many African leaders feel that they have a sovereign right to deal with whoever would help to advance the interests of African people. Now, of course, Africa is divided in so many ways, which means then that the new type of leadership in Africa, and hopefully there will be a new type, will have a worldview that sees Africa, but Africa in relationship to Asia, rather than Africa in relationship to Europe.
Many of us have invested our hopes in South Africa, a country with a revolutionary heritage and a place where almost everybody speaks in socialist terms, although not in socialist actions.
Yeah, well, South Africa took one step forward and two steps back, and they are now trying to discover ways to get back on the path and the vision that was set by the ANC in the early 1950s and was, and a lot of people don't know this, further updated at the Great Morogoro Conference of 1969, where the ANC launched upon the path of what they call class struggle and armed struggle within South Africa in the interest of seizing power in order to build socialism. The compromise made with Nelson Mandela's presidency was two steps backward. Now the question is how to move the country forward. And that is not a matter of Cyril Ramaphosa or even the African National Congress as it currently exists. A new configuration of political forces will be necessary. But the positive thing is that new currents of anti-imperialism and anti-US empire are developing throughout the world, in particular in Asia. And that gives breathing space for the revolutionary and progressive forces throughout Africa and within South Africa in particular.
Latin America at some point seemed to be on its way to immunizing itself, at least from direct U.S. military intervention. But with recent developments in Venezuela and now Nicaragua, it appears that the United States has new possibilities for meddling there.
Yeah, and the U.S. never stopped meddling there. And of course, this is another round of their attempt to exploit every contradiction in every nation. And it's not just, of course, Venezuela and Nicaragua now, but there's Chile, there's Argentina, there's Brazil, of course, the big prize. But it's a test for the people and progressive forces of those countries And I think that U.S.-sponsored counter-revolution is far more difficult than it was in the past. And, you know, in Venezuela is a case study. I mean, Venezuela, as a result of U.S. sanctions and what happened with the price of oil, was in a very weak position. But it seems that the government of Maduro and the Socialist Party and the other progressive forces have been able to hold on in spite of a furious counter-revolutionary attack. And that, to me, indicates a level of political maturity, but organizational sophistication. I think if Venezuela can, and I think it will, withstand this current attack, then that will send a message throughout Latin and South America.
In terms of this new type of peace movement in the United States, even folks who call themselves leftists seem to be more interested in shouting down the Russians than making some kind of new peace movement.
And not only shouting down the Russians, but calling for U.S. intervention in Syria. So this is a peace movement that goes back to the period of the Cold War. And all of the baggage of anti-communism and racism and pro-Americanism is part of the repertoire of many in the current peace movement. But we have to think anew. And there are people out here who are prepared and willing to think about the world in new ways. And I would say for people like those who listen to and read Black Agenda Report and those who are really interested in a progressive peace movement, the likes of those who are still mired in American nationalism and white supremacy and want to call that a peace movement, I think they are in decline. And that's why they can't build anything. And that's why the peace movement as it currently exists is a very sectarian and narrow project that does not speak to the masses of people.
Dr. Anthony Montero, the Du Boisian scholar based in Philadelphia.
Also in Philadelphia, supporters for Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, will gather on April 30th for a hearing in a Pennsylvania state court. Lawyers for Abu-Jamal believe they have a good case for overturning his conviction or gaining a new trial in the 1981 death of a police officer. Rano Castile was a top prosecutor at the time. Castile later became a judge and repeatedly turned down Mumia's appeals. Gwen Dubrow of the campaign to bring Mumia home says Castile should not have been allowed anywhere near Mumia's appeal process. She thinks there may be a real path to freedom for Abu-Jamal, but you also need big demonstrations to make that happen.
Absolutely. It's critical that we have masses of people in the streets demanding that the DA turn over all files relating to Ronald Castile's involvement in Mumia's original prosecution in 1982. They like to make us think that he had no involvement in the case, but that is patently a false argument because during Mumia's original trial, Ronald Castile was a senior assistant district attorney during that period. So he had to have been involved in Mumia's original trial. He was also involved in creating a tape, the famous McMahon tape, that taught district attorneys how to keep blacks from juries because they felt that black people couldn't be objective, critical matters and relating to police misconduct and abuse against people of color.
Yes, we've reached this juncture because of a Supreme Court decision that it's a violation of due process for a prosecutor who's played a significant role in a case to then act, once that prosecutor becomes a judge, at the appeals level. And of course, Judge Castile, former DA Castile, fits that bill.
Correct. He was elected to the district attorney office And as a district attorney, he also litigated against Mumia's appeal. So, and then he subsequently became a Supreme Court justice and ruled on Mumia's case and, of course, ruled against him, didn't recuse himself as acts. And this is what the crux of the matter is. The crux of the matter is bias. And it seems that Ronald Castile has a long, actually, history prosecuting cases and actually sentenced over 45 people to death row. He bragged about that when he was running for Supreme Court justice.
And Castile has a long history with the Fraternal Order of Police, which is a sworn enemy of Mumia Abu-Jamal.
The police funded his campaign when he ran for district attorney. They also funded his run for the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. They have actually given him an award for his staunch representation on behalf of the police. Currently, he's sitting on the district attorney's transition team, which kind of doesn't make sense, but that's just the way politics goes in Philadelphia.
Well, politics in Philadelphia underwent somewhat of a change with the election of a new district attorney who's said to be quite liberal by American standards. But has the new DA, Krasner, measured up to your expectations?
He's doing a little, some good things. As of late, heard that Meek Mill, a rapper, a well-known rapper who supported by his colleagues, other rappers like Jay-Z and T.I., he was released in part because the DA felt and believed that his prosecution and conviction was attained by false testimony of a cop. The cop said that Meek Mill pointed a gun at him, and another cop is saying that that was false, that he lied, and that was how he secured the conviction against Meek Mill. And now we're learning that that was the falsehood. He lied against Graham, a former police officer in Philadelphia, lied against Meek Mill to secure that conviction for pointing a gun at a police officer. And Meek is now free, in part because the new DA agreed that there was potential, there was perjury in the original conviction. And he supported him being released on bail. So if that's the case, he ought to be able to do the same thing in Mumia's case, because we know for sure that the police that secured the crime scene in 1981 were seen on camera. We have pictures of them mishandling the gun, mishandling this crime scene. They didn't even bother to secure it. And those same officers that were involved in helping to prosecute Mumia were then later found to be involved in corruption cases and indicted and actually served time for it. It's the same scenario of police misconduct, police framing up innocent people who they don't like.
And what about Krasner's office's behavior specifically regarding Castile and your demands that all records regarding Judge Castile, former DA Castile, be handed over?
Yes, it's critical that the new DA come clean and let us know clearly what his involvement was. We know for ourselves that that's the case. But it has to be shown in black and white for the current judge, Leon Tucker, to potentially rule in Mumia's favor to grant him his appeal so he can then proceed with his case and potentially winning a new trial, you know, perhaps. It's a long shot, but it's certainly possible because there is rampant corruption in Philadelphia, and the judges are supremely biased towards the police, and we want those records released. So Mumia's attorneys could actually look at them. That would be pretty much what we're demanding at this point, that Mumia's attorneys have full access to all the records. There are 32 boxes of case records on Mumia's case. So we would like for those records to be seen and examined by Mumia's lawyers. Currently, right now, the DA is looking at those records. And also, Judge Leon Tucker has a copy of those records. So that's where we're at now with the case.
So the DA has the records, and of course the judge is looking at records, but Mumia's lawyers don't have access yet.
Yeah, exactly, which doesn't make any sense. Leon Tucker ordered that the records be given to Mumia's attorneys, but so far that hasn't really happened. It's been ebbs and flows and not really doing what the order had said, that Mumia's and lawyers are entitled to the records. So we don't know whether they're going to turn up anything that could help the case, but we're hoping that that's going to be the case, that they're going to be forthright and giving us the information that we need to proceed.
Mumia's lawyers and his other supporters have always said that what happens in the courtrooms and the DA's office is important, but not as important as what happens in the streets. You've been organizing for 3 decades, and Mumia is known throughout the world, but even such strong movements as the one he was able to generate sometimes lose steam.
They do, but the passion is there. There are millions of people who do support Mumia. I mean, we actually have a petition that people can sign. They just go to the freemumia.com website, and there's a petition which is asking the DA to turn over all files related to Mumia's case to the attorneys. And also, we're also demanding that the DA actually and or the judges release Mumia because he is factually innocent. They don't have any material or physical evidence to link Mumia to the death of Officer Faulkner. It's all fabricated evidence.
And how is Mumia's health holding up?
He seems to be doing a little bit better. He's doing the best that he can under the circumstances. The cirrhosis of the liver seems to be acting up. It's like he's itching a lot, and they're trying to treat it, but they don't seem to really have it under control. So that's the underlying issue right now, the constant itching where he's unable to sleep. He's also losing weight. His ankles are also bloated. So it's not a good situation. He's cured of the hepatitis, but because they waited so long, they waited 2 years to treat him, he's had cirrhosis of the liver, damage to the liver. And that's causing him constant itching where he's not able to sleep all through the night. He's waking up constantly itching and having to take baths and also applying ointment to his skin. But there's some relief, but not enough where he's not complaining about it.
That was Gwen Dubrow of the campaign to bring Mumia home.
Black Colombian community organizations are demanding the release from detention of two of their leaders, Sarah Quinonez and her mother, Tulia Maris Valencia. The women are members of the Black Communities Process, or PCN, which advocates for Black territorial and civil rights in the war-torn South American country. Charo Mina Rojas is a spokesperson for the Black Communities Process. She explains what happened to her comrades.
Authorities accused of being members of the guerrilla group ELN. The guerrilla group ELN is in fact a group that has been in a process of dialogue with Colombian government. They were detained, accused of being part of this group. They were accused also of rebellion and narco-traffic activities and doing intelligence and recruitment for the guerrilla group. Those are the accusations, the charges.
What could be the basis with charging them with being part of ELN, which is a guerrilla group? The Black Communities Process Organization, to which they belong, has not been involved in armed struggle.
Exactly. We are actually a organization that promotes peace and promotes peaceful travel. And this is a difference also in terms of our defense for territorial and collective rights of Afro-descendant people. First of all, there are no real groups or any reasonable argument to say why these two women had been charged with being members of the ELN. For us, is a very political argument, a very political situation. We consider this to be a political target because we are people, and Sara and Tulia Maris were defenders of territorial rights, territories where armed groups and the state have economic interest, military interest, and we believe that we are targeted, and they were targeted basically to demobilize and silence their actions and their strong opposition to the armed presence and the illegal activities in the territories.
Yes, in fact, Afro-Colombians have been in conflict with FARC and the ELN because those groups do not necessarily respect Black people's territorial rights or indigenous rights.
Exactly, and they don't recognize the authority of the Afro-descendant community councils, which are territorial local authorities, ethnic authorities, that has the responsibility to prevent and actually care for the environmental damages that can be caused to the territories and the land. And this kind of large-scale cultivations like coca, oil, palm, or destructive activities like mining activities are activities that seriously damage and cause serious environmental problems in the territories. So the communities have been strongly opposed to these activities, and for that matter, several of the leaders of this community council and in this region have been assassinated for either armed group present in the region.
And in fact, Black Colombians have been displaced by the millions by multinational corporations and by the civil unrest in Colombia.
And the Afro-descendant people in Colombia is at least a third of the internal displaced people in Colombia. We are talking about more than 1.5 million people that have been internally displaced, dispossessed from their ancestral and collective territories, and forced to live in cities under very deplorable conditions because they lost everything. Also under racial discrimination and a lot of discrimination because of their situation. We're living in a big city where they don't have the community and all the network support that they are used to have. And we're victims and are victims of the internal armed conflict. And as victims, they have been now charged with these unfunded activities and deprived from being with their families.
And in a place like Colombia, when you're charged or it's even hinted at that you have ties with guerrillas, that sets you up for assassination. And members of the Black community's process have been assassinated.
In fact, two members of the community council that work with Sara and the community council of Alto Mira and Frontera were assassinated in the last couple of years. These have been killed by the armed groups in the territory. And those two assassinations and the threats to the community council authorities was the cause for Sara's forced displacement twice. And now they are victims of the judicialization, the criminalization of the Colombian authorities. So now if they are in the territory, they are targeted by the armed groups. If they are internally displaced, instead of being receiving the attention and the protection of the state, what they receive is criminalization. And now they are also at risk because of this situation.
And Ms. Valencia, who's been detained along with her mother, has been recognized internationally as a human rights activist.
She has been recognized internationally. This is a leader that precisely to promote the defense of the territorial rights of the community council, had traveled around the world, Europe, United States, Canada, to present this situation and advocate for support and solidarity with her community. She has protective measures from the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights that the judge completely dismissed. She has protective measures from the National Protective Units of the government, which the judge also totally dismissed. And she had the recognition of many organizations, human rights organizations, that actually wrote to the authorities to ask to ensure that Sara and her mother will be released. And all these things have been dismissed by the government. We understand that this is a political prosecution of Sara and her mother, and by extension to the PCN.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.